Good evening, everyone. Always very special to see you all. Never know who we will see. As I was sitting, it occurred to me how sometimes that sitting before a Dharma talk, I become caught in a purpose, giving my sitting some kind of purpose, like I have to really pay attention so I can grab something to say. And then when I find myself doing that, then I drop that. Because I think when I do that, when I try to grab something, I'm no longer just present to the ground of sitting and the ground of being at this moment. I'm looking for something else. So I try, and then if I try not to do that, well, then I'm also moving away from the ground of just being. I think you can recognize this. It's a very slippery slope between just being, just sitting here, being present to what is, and doing something. And I like the example of Kinhin. We don't walk to go anywhere when we do Kinhin, we just walk. Oftentimes our mind is wandering. Someone who is starting a sitting group, casual, you know, just inviting friends to come and sit. After the first session, said to me, "Oh, you know, there was a problem with the Kinhin. This guy was asking me these questions about it and saying that it would be better if everyone was doing the same thing." And so I said, "Well, so what did you tell them about Kinhin?" He said, "Well, I didn't really tell them anything. I said, "Oh, so you didn't show them how to walk or how to hold their hands or what we do?" No, none of this. So somewhere along the line, the message was not transmitted to him what we do, how to do Kinhin. And so, of course, then he didn't transmit that to the people he was sitting with. So as I was explaining to him, it really came back to me how important Kinhin really is, because it's one of the rare moments in our life when we walk with no other purpose than just to walk. And we're not even really going anywhere because we're just going around this room. We're also doing it with, it's like a choreography, like a dance. We're all dancing together, doing this dance together. And I like to point out to people when I instruct, when I give them instructions for Kinhin, that it's not, we're not taking one step after the other. It's one continuous step. There's actually not a pause. Often we notice, if you look around during Kinhin, people stop. And then they start again and lift up the foot behind. And then they stop. And then they lift up the next foot. But it's one continuous step. There is no pause, in fact. The weight just shifts from the back to the front, but there's no stopping in between. And that changes everything. When we stop, well then, we have to start again, and then we have a beginning and an end. Whereas if it's one continuous step, there's no beginning and there's no end. It's just one continuous step. And it does. We don't have to do this just in the Zendo between sitting periods. So this afternoon, I went out. Often, as you know, on Thursday afternoons, I go for a walk. Today, I had a specific place I had to be at a specific time for an appointment with someone. But I left myself enough time so that I would not be hurried. You know, I'm still recovering from COVID and I didn't know how, if I would be tired or not. I wasn't, but I didn't know. So I left myself plenty of time. And so I had this destination and I had an hour when I was supposed to be there. But apart from that, it was like kinin. I just walked. And which allowed me to experience the walk. It's streets that I walk all the time. But once again, like I've told you, sometimes when I go to the park where I walk, I change the way that I go the other way around. And so then that changes everything. I see it completely differently. Well, today I didn't do that. I didn't change the route that I was taking. But I had no intention apart from that I had to be at that destination at a certain time, which allowed me to just walk, to just appreciate. I don't think appreciate is almost even too much. Just to be aware of maybe the lilacs in bloom, the mask on the sidewalk, the guy cleaning off some obscure spots on his car. I couldn't really see the spots on his car, but he was working at it really hard. A lady digging through the trash bins. Someone with a little puppy. And the woman, I was sure I'd seen her before, but I don't know where. A father and a daughter on their bicycles, the sun coming, going in and out behind the clouds, just my feet in my shoes and my shoes on the street, the dog shit on the street, just whatever was arising at that moment. And it's not always like that when I'm walking. Often I'm thinking, you know, I have something I'm thinking about, or I'm really pressed to get to where I'm going, or I'm my shoes hurt, you know, or my shoelace is untied and it's annoying, or I'm carrying something heavy, or I forgot to bring my water or something. And then I become caught. Or I'm really involved with getting to my destination. That's usually what it is. I'm involved with getting somewhere. And that reminded me of this koan, which Dogen comments on, but it's also, I forget which collection it's in. If anyone knows what it is when I say it. It's about Basho and Nengraku. I think his name is. And Basho is sitting in his hut and Nengraku comes up to the hut and sees him sitting there, you know, arduously sitting in zazen, you know, really doing it. And Nengraku says, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm doing zazen." And Nengraku says, "Why are you doing zazen?" And he said, "Because it's so that I can become a Buddha." And Nengraku goes out and outside the hut, picks up a tile, a stone of some kind, and starts polishing it. And Basso comes out and sees him doing it and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm polishing a tile." And he said, "Why are you polishing a tile?" And Basso says, "Why are you polishing a tile?" And he said, "I'm polishing it so it will become," sometimes the translation is "a mirror" and sometimes it's "a jewel." "So I'm polishing this tile so it will become a mirror." And Basso says, "How? You can't, a tile will never become a mirror by polishing it." And Rocco says, "And you will never become a Buddha by sitting." Or how, he says, I think Basho's question is, "How can a tile become a mirror by just polishing it, by polishing it?" And then Rocco replies, "How can we become a Buddha by sitting?" And often this, you know, this is interpreted as there's no point to sit. You know, it makes it sound like, and Raku is saying it's ridiculous for Basso to be sitting, doesn't it? Well, if we just look at the facts of the Zen tradition, that can't possibly be it, right? Because what do we do all the time? We sit, right? So, so then what is he saying? What is he pointing to? I like the version of the jewel, when it, the translation when it says it's a jewel, it's, he's polishing it to make it into a jewel. Because that ties in with the idea that you are the jewel. You are the jewel that you're looking for. You are the Buddha. And no amount of polishing and no amount of sitting will make you that. You already are that. Of course, we sit because that is a way of dropping our, not even a way of, but when we sit, what happens is, we don't sit to do that, but when we sit, what happens is, we just sit still. Without a destination, it's like just walking without a destination, without an objective. Of course, this is the ideal. I'm not saying that we all do this all the time, right? When we're sitting. Often we do have an objective, even if we don't really realize it. It's like I said, I can have, be caught by an objective sitting before a Dharma talk. The objective is, what will I say in the Dharma talk? But actually, that's really beside the point. The sitting is what is important. The sitting is what it's about. It's not whatever you're looking to obtain. Even saying, you know, the way, with a capital W. Actually, the way, or the path, as we say, is off the path. It's Gary Snyder, the American poet Gary Snyder, who talks about the wild, the wilderness. That's the way. If we're sticking to some path, with an objective, a path that goes from point A to point B, well, we miss the path. Today, if I had been focused only on going to that meeting and what would happen at that meeting and being there at the right time and who I was going to meet and what she would say and everything, I would have missed all, I would have missed the path. I had to go off the path in order to experience the path. In other words, something like that. That's the wild. That's Gary Snyder's wild. Um, Or, you know, you can, before I went out for my walk, I went into my garden with a cup of tea, with no intention other than just sitting in the garden with a cup of tea. No other plan, no other objective, no notebook, no cameras, no watch, nothing. I also know the opposite. I tell the story sometimes where you know, when my kids were small and I was diapers and taking to school and picking up at school and making lunches and putting to bed and everything, when I would have a free moment when I could take a break, I would say, okay, I'm going to go into my room, lie down, take a break. And I would bring the newspaper with me. I would bring my notebook with me. I would bring a book with me. And then I would be like, well, this is not a break. This is not a break. When we break, we break. When we write, we write. When we read the newspaper, we read the newspaper. When we sit, we sit. When we walk, we walk. It's not easy. It sounds very simple, but as you can all recognize, it's not easy. Especially in our time of multitasking and, you know, this and this, so easy to move away from just this, just this, just this, just this. And yet that's where freedom is. That's where the wild is. That's where creativity is. What makes it so difficult though is because it's impermanent, right? So I was talking with a poet friend yesterday over lunch, who we don't usually talk about our writing. I mean, we talk about whatever, her latest book or something, but we don't really talk about our process. And somehow the process of her latest book, she was telling about it. And suddenly we started talking about it and we had the same impression of, we never know what we're doing. And when we know what we're doing, well, then it's not it. I'm, you know, summarizing this, but we'd never know what we're doing. We're just writing. So this book she was writing, she had no idea what she was doing, but she just kept doing it. And after much work, you know, she said she spent 15 years trying to write this book and she has 10 versions. She threw them all away and just said, I don't know, started writing from, I don't know, this ground of impermanence. I don't know. Try it. Even, I'm not saying you have to write a book, but go out for a walk on the ground of impermanence. Just walk. In your sitting, just sit. See what happens. We get really easily caught though. I sometimes tell the story of when I taught children meditation and I would give them the breathing practice, counting their breath. In order to make it a little easier, I would give them each a pile of stones, little stones. And when they would finish a cycle of 10 breaths, they could move a stone to the other side from the right to the left, just to give them a little extra structure. Well, it completely backfired because it became a race to see who could transfer the stones to the other side quickest. So very quickly they were caught in an objective instead of just sitting there and counting their breaths. So I abandoned the stones. At some point, we abandon the count as well. I'm talking for those of us who practice more regularly. With children, you know, you got to kind of keep some structure. But eventually, we abandon the count. Eventually, we abandon the breath. The universe is breathing. The breath is the universe. As soon as we start thinking that, well, then we have to start over again because we've lost it again. So you see how the possibilities of this having an objective, or another exercise I would do with children was I would put a tray full of objects, all kinds of things, you know, like pens, you know, toys, a bit of paper, a piece of food, a cookie, a cup, anything, just all the objects I could find randomly on this tray. So, and I would have it covered with a cloth, and then I would take it off and I would say, just look at it. Just look. And then we would cover it up. And then I would say, okay, now write down everything that you saw. Now, if I had told them before that they would have to write down everything they saw, they wouldn't have looked at the tray in the same way. They would have looked at it with the subjective of having to write things down. And then I would, when they, you know, I would ask them to turn around or something, and I would take an object away. And then I would uncover the tray again, and I would say, okay, now look at it again. Okay. And then cover it up, and I would say, okay, there is an object that was missing. What was it? Now, if I had said before that, I'm taking something away, they would have looked and tried to figure out what had been taken away. But because they didn't say that, they were just looking at it again. And often if they were paying attention, they would see what object was missing. Especially if it was an object that they liked, you know, a ball or a cookie or, you know, a Pokemon card or something. Now we can do this for ourselves. We can like take away the objective ourselves. You know, we could say, okay, I'm just going to sit without making a list of what I see or looking for what's missing. Usually that's what we do. We look for what's missing, what we don't want. Something we want is not there. Or something we really don't want is there and we want to get rid of it. So we all, you know, we get quickly caught with an objective. But it's possible to just not have those objectives. Now I can hear the wheels of the mind turning and saying, okay, well, so then that becomes an objective. To not have an objective. Well, it does. So we have to let go of that too. You know, like Maizumi Roshi said to Bernie Glassman when Maizumi was not a Roshi yet and Bernie was just learning Kinhin. And he said, why do we walk? Why do we do this walking? Maizumi Roshi's response, when we walk, we just walk. For Bernie, this, you know, astrophysicist, this was like mind-blowing. When we walk, we just walk. And the simplicity, the radical simplicity of it is mind-blowing, actually. So, Anyone have anything to say? Questions, comments, reactions? Ready?
Sun Tan used to say, wanting enlightenment is a big mistake. Every time I heard that, it was a shock for me.
Wanting said that? Who used to say that?
Sun Tan.
Sun Tan. Oh, yeah.
So to me, the first time I heard that, it was a shock. A shock.
So why was it a shock? Because...
why do we see it? Why? To me, I was learning meditation. I was. It seems to be the natural aim of why we see it, to be enlightened, to discover what it is, enlightenment. To me, it was natural. So the time I've heard it, I was. Why? What? You removed why I was there, why I wanted to. So it's like walking and going nowhere. Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Mingyur in his. Mingyur Rinpoche, in his recent book, who tells the story of when he was a 12-year-old boy, and his father was a great Rinpoche. And so he used to go have lunch with his father, and one day he went and he wanted to show him how good he was at sitting and dwelling in the nature of mind and how what a good meditator he was and how much he realized when he's 12 years old. And his father said to him, so what are you doing? And he said, oh, you know, I'm dwelling in the nature of mind or something like that. And his father said, it's all fake. The whole thing is fake. All the techniques, all the practice, all the teachings, it's all fake. For this 12-year-old boy whose father is this amazing, you know, world-known Rinpoche and is training to be a monk, and his father is telling him it's all fake. It's kind of like Sun Sanim saying, it's a big mistake. And Mingyur says, you know, it took him a while. Years, in fact. He never forgot that his father said that, but it took him years and years to really start understanding what his father was saying. Christine?
Good evening. At some point, I just remembered a scientific study that I read not long ago. Maybe you know it. I have already heard about it too. So it must be quite well known. And the researchers asked volunteers to spend 15 minutes in a room without any distraction. So no telephone, no games, no nothing to look at, just spending 15 minutes just like that. And most of the participants did not appreciate the the 15 minutes. And then in another setting, when they proposed a machine that gave painful but not dangerous electroshocks, two-thirds chose to have electroshocks instead of nothing. So rather some physical sensation of pain rather than it's quite impressive, isn't it?
And did the scientists draw some conclusions from that, or
I don't know. It's in a book of Christophe André, who is meditating and writing books about meditation. So I didn't read the original scientific review. It just I had already heard or read about that in another book, I think. And I guess it's just this discomfort of if you're not used to facing yourself and being with nothing other than yourself in an environment without any distraction possible, then you prefer, you know, any stimulation that takes the attention outside of. So, but that's more my interpretation.
Yeah, and I was curious to know if they had that same interpretation, because we do, you know, we suffer. We don't have electroshocks, but we're suffering. We're uncomfortable. We have stuff we don't like, you know, we're unhappy. And yet we prefer that to just, quote, nothing, or just sitting, you know. It's true. We fill up that space of nothing, quote, with lots of stuff. Yeah. Even painful, even if it's painful, yeah.
Can you say a bit more about that? You know, that we prefer that stuff within us that is painful than nothing? Can you?
Yeah, well, you know, I think probably everyone recognizes it too. We have what's familiar, you know, we're so familiar, we're so identified with our, you know, anger or our
stories we tell ourselves.
Right, yeah, or feeling lonely or whatever it is that's happening. Stories, patterns, conflicts we're having or something. And we're so familiar with that. And in unconsciously even, it's as if we let go of that, well, then who are we? What is there if there's not that? And yet that all of that is as unreal as the shadow of Seu's cat on her wall there, you know? I mean, it's all of that stuff, it's just a thought. It has no consistency, you know? And yet we're so identified with it and so afraid of what would happen, because it's all of that is me, right? And I'm identified with me being solid, because the alternative is terrifying. There's no me. There's nothing. Everything is impermanent. It's not solid. I have nothing to hang on to. So we prefer what's uncomfortable to what we don't know. Although we think we know it. Yeah. We prefer that. And the self has a lot invested in it, because this idea of self, if we look into it really, we will see that it doesn't exist. So this self that we're identified with, its survival depends on maintaining all the distractions and the stories. I mean, that's kind of a brief resume of it, but I think everybody probably recognizes some stuff in that.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me also of something, maybe it's not really related, but also with people getting used to a lot of stress, really from, let's say, childhood on, or, you know, that the nervous system is really always in fight or flight, that then for those children, a relaxed state is boring. There's nothing happening, you know, you can get attached or used to this, to the fight or flight survival response, and having that going on all the time that you don't appreciate anymore in the first, you know, when things change, that it seems too boring. You prefer it. So something like that too. So.
Yeah. Or even, you know, associate, you know, sometimes conflict with love. So we have a conflictual relationship with someone, and that's our way of expressing love. It sounds kind of odd, but it does happen. Because that's what we learned.
All the patterns and...
Yeah.
Amy, did you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. It's surprising that the discussion is about that tonight, because this weekend my mobile was he was showing an apple, and he stayed on the apple for 3 days, so I but everything is on my phone, so I couldn't call, but I couldn't receive any calls, and all the numbers and everything were there. So, and at first, I thought he was going to come back to normal, so I didn't pay too much attention. But during the weekend, he stayed on the apple. He was just sewing the apple, and it was so interesting the way that. I was cut from the world. It was something weird, because I understood how much it was my connection to the world, to the outside. And it was really strange, because if I wanted to do something, if I go somewhere, and now I'm used to watch on the map or something. So I didn't know how to do things. If I wanted to go somewhere, I couldn't watch my phone anymore. And it was so funny, because I had my guitar class, and I went to the class, but the teacher didn't answer when I ring at the door, but I couldn't call him. So I missed my class, because nobody was on the door and I couldn't call him. And everything was like this. And after one day, I felt like it was so special that, but in a way, I felt, it's funny because you said the word wild. I think it's very interesting, because I couldn't put a word on this state, on what was happening. And now that you say wild, it's so perfect. And, but at one point, I felt kind of protected, so I could have done something about my phone, but I stayed like this. I thought I was interesting, and I think I felt really protected in my from the outside world, and I felt very well. And until I went to the meditation on Tuesday morning in Dana, and when I sat, it was I felt something really strong, like. I don't know, for me it was because it was like loneliness. It was like a strong, strong feeling of loneliness. Like if I could touch it. Okay. And now my phone is working again, but it was really going through something really singular.
Yeah, wow. I like that calling it wild. It is, huh? That's a really good. Yeah, really good. Seu, yeah.
You know, everybody. It's like today when I go to walk a little bit, and in the morning, only to feel the air and the sun, and I go to a place to buy some bread, and I saw the first time that we are not obliged to to take a mask. We were in the retreat, and I didn't know. And oops! Oh, we don't want to. We don't have to have. We don't be obliged to take the mask. And it was very. It's something new, something good. And I asked the woman. It was this weekend. Oh, it's last Saturday. Last Saturday, it's the rule. We don't need to put a mask when you go in a supermarket. And I didn't. I was happy with it. And when I come to in this walk, I observe, because I saw so many people that walk against me because they look at the phone, the telephone. They look at the telephone and go, and I need to go up there because so many people, and I think, I need to look where I go because they walk against the people. Yes, it was my walk today morning.
Yeah, the masks are a good example because we've become so accustomed to it that, oh, I don't have it. Yeah. And what is it like to not have it?
I think it's a supermarket where I go regularly, and I didn't know the face of the woman and it was really, I was really happy to see.
Nice to see you all tonight, as always. I was struck by this, what Christine was saying about it's preferable to get a shock than to be bored situation. I have two things like that, and it's really obvious to me right now because I don't have a lot to do, so I have time to be aware of it. I have worked for years on two fronts. One is cigarette smoking, which I haven't done since January this year, and the other is being angry most of the time, some of the time, a lot of the time, which I started working on in 2007, just to say it's been a long story. And I'm kind of getting, I don't want a cigarette, but I do want to be a smoker it's very exciting to be a smoker. The minute you get mad, for example, you have something exciting to do. It physically makes you all kind of jumpy and nervous. And although I recognize intellectually that that's really stupid way to treat my body. I prefer it to being calm. I have to admit. And the other thing is that I've just had a little moment. I haven't been mad, I don't know, in days, weeks. I mean, mad where I'm walking into the house and I want to get my box off. And I telephone older people for different reasons. And the one I called tonight sort of castigated me because the last time I helped with a wheelchair, I didn't do it very well. This was weeks ago. I'm calling to see how she is and everything. She said, well, you didn't do that very well. When I got the phone, I thought, oh, bitch, that's awful. I put time aside to talk to you and everything, and all you do is tell me how poorly, what a poor helper I am. And it got to me. I started kind of telling the cat how annoying this was that I had taken time out to help this woman that she didn't appreciate, you know. And I could feel it. As I said, I haven't been angry, really, in several days. I could feel how exciting it was. I was kind of having a good time. I mean, she wasn't there, so I wasn't hurting or anything. And the air was getting all kind of circulating faster. And I thought, I really miss this, actually. I miss being a cigarette-smoking, angry woman. What am I going to do? But it's true. It's in a way preferable to just sitting there dumbly. So I can really relate to this example. Yeah.
So if you prefer being the angry smoker, why are you trying to stop smoking and stop being angry?
Well, I've heard from hearsay that it's better. Yeah. No, there have been moments, especially in the last year or so, where I have not become angry. Somebody telling me, if somebody that I don't know, like using the machine in Carrefour, paying with the machine, for example, if somebody who is impatient that I'm not doing it faster starts showing that to me, I can just go, even if I don't express anything in my head, I am killing. And the first time I wasn't, it was such a pleasure. I got halfway across the parking lot and I thought, you forgot to get mad. I couldn't, it was like having a different personality. It was so exciting. But it's not exciting every day, you know, some days it's kind of boring. And I got sick of smoking. I just got sick of it. So I know that I'm not going to like it anymore. It's just that feeling of nostalgia. I don't want to smoke a cigarette. I want to be a smoker. I don't know if this speaks to any of the smokers, the ex-smokers or whatever. I hit on other people's cigarettes and it's disgusting and it stinks. But I miss being a smoker. I miss being that person. But it's better. I mean, it's qualitatively better not to smoke and not to be angry. It's just that sometimes kind of boring.
Yeah, that's a very important point about considering yourself as a smoker. For those people, it's much more difficult to quit than if you just say, well, I smoked cigarettes for some time, or, you know, if you say I'm, what's the name, if you, you participate how's it called? I don't find the words in English. When there's elections and you go to vote, if you consider yourself a voter, is that the English word?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then you're more likely to really go to it than if you just say, yeah, maybe sometimes I participate, or if you're think of yourself, you're a voter, you also do it. So, and that's the same for a smoker. All the identities help to maintain the status quo. But maybe you can get a new one, or you drop all the identity.
Well, that's what our practice is about. It's
yes,
we are not what we think we are, what we're identified with. Absolutely. Yeah.
So congratulations, Debbie.
Yeah.
That's a big step.
But you are so right. I don't know if any of you all have ever smoked. Us smokers think that you non-smokers are really boring people. I mean, but I swear, there's a whole philosophy that goes with being outside in the freezing cold, sticking this thing in your mouth and saying, well, at least we're interesting.
No, I know. And at parties and things, always the fun stuff was going on with the smokers. You know, they were having fun out there. Or what I know. Retreats, the smoking area used to be like, you know, like that fun place to be. I was not smoking in those days. I smoked a long, long time ago, but that's exactly it. It's these identities we have and that we become prisoners to those identities. And so the idea of the practice, let's say even more so the idea that what this practice is about is letting go of those identities. And then we find out who we truly are. And then we are free. Then we really have fun.
Debbie, the fun place now on retreat is where we do the singing and music.
And it all depends on circumstances. I had a Swedish colleague who said, oh, well, in Sweden, smoking is so uncool because you're the only person who has to go outside if you want to smoke. And all the other ones can stay inside and where it's warm and where the music is. And so, a long time ago when it was, I think in France, when I arrived, you could still smoke in the pubs and restaurants. Mm-hmm. In Germany, it was already forbidden, and in Sweden, probably for a long time. And then it came too in France. So that might help to shift a little bit the perception of of the coolness of smoking or not.
Well, and just our culture in general, the coolness of having an identity.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that you're supposed to have an identity and you're supposed to display it on social media and you're supposed to, you know, be like this. Or, you know, I am smart or I'm not smart or...
Or be part of a group, right. A certain group.
Yeah, identify with. So you see why this practice is radical. Subversive, as I like to say. Going into the wild. Freddie? Yeah?
And what is sometimes difficult too is to let go of... to be in love with your own thoughts when you're sitting and you're thinking about something, you think you're smart, and you have to let go of the thinking that you're thinking something smart and you're thinking it's sometimes difficult. Mm. Because you can't even be in love with what you think.
Because in fact, they're not your thoughts either. We think that that's mine, but it's not. So that's a big delusion too, yeah.
Well, I know time is short, but if you could talk about this at some further time when we have more time. This one kind of goes by me. It's not my thoughts. I'm not sure I understand what we're talking about.
Well, I don't think in 4 minutes we have time really, except to say that if we look into, okay, what is the nature of a thought? What is the nature of the one who's thinking? We see that it's just thought. And who we think is thinking is just another thought. We're so identified with it, though, that's a big, big chunk of the iceberg right there. In fact, that's the whole iceberg. That's the whole thing right there.
If I dare to say, it's just the wind blowing through the trees.
Well, and then we could say, well, is the wind blowing or are the trees moving? So maybe we should stop with that. Do our vows. Thank you, everyone. I remind you that we have a study group on Saturday, sitting, of course, the usual times, morning and Tuesday and Thursday nights. Also remind you to, if you're interested, sign up for the May retreat, because limited places, and it's in person, so it will not be online, the May retreat in France. And then also Joa is leading a retreat in July, also limited places. And then the summer retreat in Portugal, there are people who are already signing up, and that also is limited. It's more than the May and July retreats, but don't forget to sign up if you're interested in attending. Thank you.